Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, he's been out of office for 10 years. Rod Blagojevich today sits in a federal prison halfway through his sentence for corruption. A new podcast revisits what happened back then and where things stand now for the impeached former governor, including a conversation with his wife, Patty. She recounts the morning her husband was arrested.
First, the phone rang.
Is this in your bedroom?
Yeah, bedroom upstairs.
Rod answered the phone and then handed it to Patty.
I hung up on him because I thought, like, this is a prank call. Call back, they're like, no, this is the FBI. Come down over here and break the door down.
More on the podcast, Public Official A, coming up this hour. Also, many Illinois cities, including those near you, are segregated. What you might not know is those towns rank among the most segregated in the country. All that and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. Ahead this hour, a new podcast follows the Rod Blagojevich story, then and now. It's called Public Official A. We'll talk with the reporter behind it. Also, a man who went to prison, now free and in his 50s, he's obtained a college degree. Perry Klein's story, that's coming up later. And cybersecurity is a growing industry. Mary Hansen takes a look at what the state can do to be a leader. That and more this hour on Statewide. Let's start the show this week by taking a look at some of the most segregated communities in the country, places where the problem persists and has so for years, with little improvement. You might think I'm talking about the Deep South. Instead, I'm referring to Illinois and some of its larger cities. A six-month Governing magazine investigation culminated in a series published this week. Reporters Dan Vock and Brian Charles culled data and tracked down numerous sources. They lay out the numbers and some of the reasons segregation remains so prominent in towns like Springfield, Rockford, Peoria, Champaign-Urbana, Bloomington-Normal, and Decatur. And they join us on this week's Statewide. Dan, I'm going to start with you. I think most of us in communities like Springfield, Peoria, Rockford, other places probably realize that there is segregation. I think maybe are a bit surprised when we see where Illinois ranks on a national level.
I lived in downstate Illinois for a number of years, too, and obviously the towns are segregated, but it's hard to know how out of the ordinary that is until you sort of step back a little bit and take the national perspective. It really is stark, and that was why it was good to have a team of reporters on this. So Brian has lived in the Northeast in California, so when he saw it, it was very shocking to him, whereas it's something that a lot of us just take for granted if that's what you grew up with.
There's some assumptions that we think of segregation as this vestige of the past, this thing that's almost something we teach in history classes. And we forget that for a lot of these communities, especially the industrial communities, oftentimes the situation about segregation is almost like frozen. And it's been frozen to some degree over a course of decades. And I think that that's the part that when you start to look at, you know, the data points and you start to get on the ground, you start seeing this a scenario in which the conditions that we think about historically are still very much present in the physical spaces that people occupy.
Let's talk about some of those reasons. I think you both have written in there in this series that this is not by chance and that local governments have played a role in keeping segregation going in most of these towns.
I think that's right, Sean. I think one of the things that you don't think about is if it's always been done this way, you're not really thinking about what you would need to change that. So, you know, there were racist policies of the past, like redlining and, you know, just other sort of discrimination in lending and that type of deal, which may have started the separation of races in these cities. But as it goes forward, if you notice the patterns, you know, the investment keeps going to new areas to where white residents go. Some of the historically black neighborhoods struggle to get investment. You know, it continues, but it doesn't seem like it's different because that's sort of, you know, the generally speaking, the black side of town has always been more poor, and the white side of town has been, you know, more affluent.
When we're talking about these two sides of town, I think you point this out as well. Almost all of these communities have a real geographic dividing line. There's maybe it's a street or a railroad or something that tends to divide white and black.
Yeah, it was very clear in a couple of the communities, Springfield Railroad Track and in Champaign, we noted University Avenue, and in Rockford, the river, although that's not as that is not as hard and fast. There's some folks that live on what is considered, you know, the white side of the river. You know, it's interesting when you just talk about this, is that it does become accepted, and I think there's a part of it that starts to begin to accept that the conditions of certain people just fit a preconceived narrative we have about race and class and those things. And so we begin to accept that, and it becomes normal to us.
One other thing that was striking to, I think, both of us is, you know, if you're on the white side of town, you may never go to the black side of town. It may be 2 miles away, and, you know, you may go months without going there, and vice versa. And, I mean, it just sort of shows those patterns of segregation, and that, you know, if you aren't actively looking for it or at it, then it may be easy to forget if you're not actively pursuing that. And I think that also leads to sort of this, the reason why it doesn't change is because people are comfortable where they are, and why change the status quo.
I'm talking with Dan Vock and also Brian Charles. They're both reporters for Governing Magazine, and they have done a series after a 6-month-long investigation into segregation and why it persists so heavily here in Illinois, especially in communities like Springfield and other central Illinois towns, or maybe Rockford, for example. And Brian, one of the things you touched on was black side of town versus the white side of town. And I know I have talked to white residents who will often say, well, why don't people on the other side of town, why don't they fix up that neighborhood? Why don't they do something more with it? Because it does look more run down. There's not as much opportunity there. Why don't they do something about it?
Well, the issue then becomes, when you have disinvestment in the community and you have decades of disinvestment in the community, what capital are you going to work with to actually make that community stronger? You know, we looked at Springfield, for example, and we looked at places on the west side of Springfield in which home prices in predominantly black neighborhoods, which were nice, which were kept up, which were, very well maintained, you know, cul-de-sacs, that kind of thing, things we think about when we think about affluent, you know, suburban neighborhoods, in which those home prices were dramatically lower than what we found on the other side of Springfield, in which the home prices in similarly looking neighborhoods, homes that were of a similar size, were dramatically more valuable. And that value was very much attached to, you know, the demographics surrounding the neighborhood. The demographics were poor, the demographics were black, the demographics in, you know, maybe in some cases were lower income and, you know, lower middle class. But race became really the through line there that said, this is how much money you're going to get for your home, and this is how much money someone on the other side of town is going to get for their home. And without that investment, without that capital to work with, it is very hard for you to scale up the type of investment you need in the community to bring in things like grocery stores, to bring in jobs, to bring in, you know, any of those things. I mean, you don't have to look too deep in the news beyond what we've done to see exactly where corporate investment has gone as far as, you know, your headquarters for companies and whatnot. They're not going to communities that have suffered from disinvestment for decades. They're going to communities that are already affluent.
And Sean, there's a little bit there where there's both private investment and public investment. If you look at some of the neighborhoods in, say, the east side of Springfield, as Brian mentioned, there are some very nice neighborhoods. There are also neighborhoods on that side that have, you know, no sidewalks, no curbs, poor lighting. The infrastructure isn't there. The lots are small. There are a lot of vacant houses. So the development is moving towards bigger lots on the new development out west, and that is easier to attract investment from. If you're going on the east side, you're talking about, you know, rundown streets that, you know, with small lots, a lot of infrastructure challenges that you don't have on the west side. So there's both public and private. You know, the east side, the public investment they get are housing projects tax credits to build low-income housing. On the west side, you know, you're getting, you know, developers building out, you know, brand new subdivisions.
Dan, talk a bit about schools as well. The Peoria area, I was stunned to learn this, has the most segregated public schools among black and white students of any metropolitan area in the nation, according to your report.
What we are looking at is the metro area, so across the entire Peoria metropolitan area. So the one thing that's very striking is that within Peoria schools, they do, you know, a decent job. They still have segregation, but it's not as stark as across the entire metropolitan area. So one thing that you'll hear about are desegregation lawsuits that try to get, like, Champaign or Springfield still under a desegregation order from the 70s. And that's all within these sort of central core areas. But what's happening is that white residents are leaving the district completely. Now, a lot of times, in the case of Peoria, they're going to Dunlap School District and still have a Peoria address. But the city has sprawled far enough away from the center of the city that it's now the new development is out in, you know, new school districts. And that's happened in Springfield, too. On the fringes of Springfield, you know, there's Chatham and there's Pleasant Plains, and there's just a whole bunch of development outside of the core school district. And what that means is that the schools themselves in the urban, the core urban areas, are becoming more and more black, while the white students are sort of fleeing out to, you know, the exurbs or the, you know, farm towns or even the fringes of the city that they're on. So that's really the important thing to keep in mind, is that you can't just look within one school district, because sometimes those school district boundaries are fueling segregation. So in that case of the two houses, one on the east side and one on the west side of Springfield, one of the big differences is that the east side school, the house is in the Springfield School District, and the west side, which you wouldn't know from looking at it, is actually on a school, you know, 8 miles away.
One of the sources that you spoke with used the term unintended racism. I thought that was interesting. Can you explain what they're getting at there?
I think the source we're referring to is Kate Pistuccia, who is an elected official in Peoria County. She was referring to the fact that a lot of her parents that she knows, a lot of her neighbors, are in effect saying to themselves, "Hey, listen, this situation in Peoria is not going to work out for my child. I want what I think is a higher quality education, and I'm moving on to another school district." They may not be intentionally doing something that they say they don't want to send their kids to school with black children, or, you know, but what they're doing in effect is they're taking their children out of the school district, and with that, oftentimes, because we have a disparity in resources in Illinois and across the country, they're taking their resources with them. And so it's not an intentional situation in which somebody says, "I don't like these folks, I don't want to go to school with them." But the impact for them is to reinforce the tiered system that we currently have.
Before we run out of time, I do want to give both of you the opportunity to weigh in on this, and that is, what do you hope people take away from this? I think, again, as we mentioned at the start, people understand there is segregation that is in place and has been for generations in many of these communities. What do you hope they learn from looking at the numbers and the stories that you're telling?
I think there's a few things. One, I think it's important to realize that you know, segregation isn't just Chicago or St. Louis or Gary, that this happens across the country, but especially in the Midwest and the Northeast. Second of all, that public policy by local officials, even today, matters. And so what, you know, where you're developing, where development is allowed to go, where you're investing your taxpayer money, and where you're siting, you know, new developments, all that still matters. And the other thing is that, conversely to that, is even though the public policy reinforces all this and makes it harder to sort of break out of the system, individual choices matter. As Brian was saying, when you move your kid out of a predominantly or a minority school district and you move across the river, then your resources go with you, you know, as a white parent, then that has an effect. And, you know, when you and your friends and everybody else, all your neighbors do the same thing, that's how you get disinvestment in communities. That's how you get segregated neighborhoods.
You know, what I would hope, though, and I think all of us have hoped this, is that, you know, some of the folks that are in position to be to create policy, whether it be in Illinois or other places within the country that look at this, start to, you know, Dan is talking about it, about policy versus individual choices, and I think the individual choices matter, but I also think that policy leaders have to do the exact thing that we're asking policy leaders to do, which is to lead. And to say, you know, we're going to find a way to, in the case of Illinois with its 850-plus school districts, we're going to have to find a way to figure out how to make sure that this cleaving that we're seeing in places like Peoria and places across the state doesn't necessarily lead to the draining of resources from urban core school districts. I think we also need to think about housing policy and where we build and how we build. Even some of the solutions that we saw on the ground that you'll see in the series are really, some of them are well-intended, but they may not actually fix the issue of segregation. So we need to think about that. I think we need to think about larger policies of law enforcement. And I think policy leaders have to try to lead and maybe perhaps if they do so, that can at least either mitigate or inspire people to make better individual choices around how we choose to live as a country.
That's Brian Charles along with Dan Vock. They're both reporters for Governing Magazine. And thanks to both of you for talking with us this week on Statewide.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to their series on segregation in Illinois. It's at our website, statewideshow.com. Check it out. The numbers might surprise you. Also, a reminder to follow us on Facebook. Keep up with Statewide and what we're working on. You can also weigh in on the stories and interviews you hear on the program each week. Coming up next, Rod Blagojevich remains in federal prison, only about halfway through his sentence for corruption. A new podcast looks back at the impeached former governor and talks to many of those who are part of the Blagojevich saga, from his wife to the federal agents who arrested him. And we'll talk with the reporter who's behind it. That's coming up on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. Coming up, we'll hear about a former prison inmate who's not letting that stop him from his dream of college. And death, it's a part of life. We'll visit a school in Illinois offering a degree in mortuary science. Those stories and more still ahead. It was 10 years ago this month, Rod Blagojevich was impeached and removed as governor of Illinois. Blagojevich was later convicted of corruption, including attempts to sell the U.S. Senate seat. He received a 14-year sentence and remains in prison. Reporter Dave McKinney covered it all as a Statehouse reporter. Today, he works for public station WBEZ in Chicago. And he's launched a podcast called Public Official A, in which he recounts what happened a decade ago and updates it by talking with those who played a role in the story. And I talked with Dave McKinney about that project. The whole state, the whole country actually watched this unfold as this drama was taking place back when Rod Blagojevich was brought up on charges following his arrest, when he was, you know, sent out of office. Why decide to tackle this issue now 10 years later?
Well, I mean, of course, the anniversary is there, but I think the bigger thing is that you know, Donald Trump has sort of made the Rod Blagojevich story timely again. I mean, he you know, is on Air Force One back at the end of May and surprises everybody and says, you know, I'm thinking about commuting Rod Blagojevich's sentence. He should have never been in prison. He said stupid things, but it's not any different than what anybody else said. And so that, of course, then takes everybody by surprise, including Patty Blagojevich. And then it goes on into the, you know, it opens the door to this whole campaign on her part to try to get him free. I mean, she'd been doing it before, but it really kind of took off after that.
Well, is there a lot we don't know about this story? Again, because it was so public, almost everything. These people were, you know, going on television to proclaim his innocence. We were hearing all about the investigation. We heard the tapes, of course, that were played. What do we not know about this?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, the temptation, journalistically, the temptation with these stories that, you know, happened 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 40 years ago is to just kind of, you know, summarize what happened, and they turn into kind of clip jobs, and they're not that engaging or interesting. But what made this kind of different, I think, was the ability to sit down with all of these participants. I suspect my producer Colin McNulty and I, we wound up speaking to probably 14 or 15 different participants, you know, on the investigative side, of course, Mrs. Blagojevich, you know, some of his former key aides. And it's just interesting, you know, now I guess with the luxury of time, people feel a little freer to open up and give insights into things. And it truly was a remarkable kind of thing to do to sit down with Mrs. Blagojevich for 6 hours. You know, after a certain period of time, you know, when you're talking to someone that long, they kind of get off their talking points. And then that's when you start to hear things like, you know, how the Blagojevich's youngest daughter, when you know, all of this talk of Rod possibly coming home early, when it happens and then, it, you know, nothing evolves from that, she stops reading his emails from prison because it's just too hard to take. You know, you hear details like that. The fact that, you know, we were sitting down in the same study where, you know, one of the phones was tapped. I mean, that was kind of an eye-opening experience to be welcomed at the door of their house on the northwest side of Chicago, welcomed in, and we go into this library, and one of the first things that Mrs. Blagojevich says is, oh, there's the phone they tapped, you know, and it's and sitting on a little library table is the, you know, is this old landline that they have, for whatever reason, they still have in their house. And so, you know, you get details and nuances like that about, you know, kind of inner thoughts that you wouldn't normally hear on these Fox News interviews that she's been doing.
Well, I'm sure you had to have some type of image of Patty Blagojevich before you started this project, this podcast. In the first episode, you talk, as you mentioned, a lot with her, going into her home. She really seems to let her guard down. Did your image of her change a bit?
Well, I mean, I think that's fair to say. I mean, you know, again, with that amount of time, I mean, a person's humanity kind of comes through. And, you know, I think the tapes that were played, you know, during the criminal trials, and especially the ones with her where, you know, they were profanity laced. I mean, she kind of had this image as a Lady Macbeth kind of character. And I think, you know, that description, I think, might have been coined by the Tribune in one of their stories. But it was, you know, you come away with the idea, here's a person who is just sort of desperate to reunite her family. She's, you know, sort of looks at this whole political career of her husband's as, you know, wishing it hadn't happened. I think Colin and I really kind of got immersed into the, you know, the family dysfunction that has occurred as a result of her husband going away to prison for so long.
And you also, as you mentioned, talked to some of the officers who actually went to the door that day and arrested him, how they called beforehand, met at a restaurant nearby and, you know, had breakfast, I guess, got ready and then made the call. You're kind of getting the view of people who played parts in this, but maybe we didn't know their story.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, you know, one of the agents that we spoke with, you know, has spoken publicly, but in very dry terms, and only, you know, Daniel Kane is one of the agents that was involved in the arrest, and you know, with his partner Patrick Murphy, the two of them had, you know, they monitored literally hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of you know, conversations that the Blagojeviches were having. And, you know, Kane spoke during the impeachment, you know, tribunal in Springfield. And then I believe he also was a witness in the criminal trial. But, you know, in those environments, you, as a reporter, Sean, you remember what that's like. I mean, it was a very dry kind of bit of testimony. And here what we have is sort of the TikTok of, you know, of what, you know, what it's like to sort of plan all of this out and then to execute it. And you know, with both agents, I mean, you know, we associate their work with Blagojevich himself, and it most certainly was. But you know, these guys, they got their toes wet in the whole situation here, going back to 2003, where they field this phone call. One of them does in the suburban Lyle FBI office from this woman who was a CEO at a Naperville hospital called Edward Hospital, and that. That's the very beginning of all of this, where Edward Hospital wanted to expand. They had to take their project in front of the Illinois Health Facilities Planning Board, which is the regulatory panel that approves hospital projects. And what they find shortly after going, you know, presenting their case there is that, you know, there are corrupt board members, and one in particular, Stu Levine, is encouraging them to use a particular contractor and a particular lender, and that if they do those things and pay them money and that you know, kickbacks arise out of it and everything, you know, she calls him up and says, "Wait a minute, I'm being shaken down." And that's when the recording starts. And it's such a rich piece of information, new information really, about how, you know, this one particular case, it was like the beginning domino to fall. And Pam Davis was the name of the CEO. We sat down with her, and you know, she talked in detail about what it was like to be wearing a wire in her bra, no less, and going to restaurants in the western suburbs, talking to some of these corrupt players and getting them on tape, which then was the first rung on the ladder. And from there, these two agents took us on this journey all the way to the front door of the Blagojevich house and what the arrest was like.
The call was being made, and at that point, we were heading toward the door.
He answered the phone immediately, explained to him that we had agents outside his door. We'd like to do this as quickly and quietly as possible. And he obviously, you know, as anybody might in his position, say, "Is this a joke?" And I said, "No, I can assure you it's not a joke." But I think he just gave the phone to Patty.
I hung up on him because I thought, like, this is a prank call.
I mean, she and Rod were in bed still. It was still very early morning. And between them was their youngest daughter, Annie. And the phone rings, and Rod picks it up and hands it to Patty. And then it's, you know, an FBI agent saying, "We're at your door, let us in, or we're going to break the door down." And she's like, "Oh, come on, this is a joke." Click, hangs up. And then they call back, and then it's clear to both the Blagojeviches that this is not a joke, and it's very real. And, you know, in the span of several minutes there, you know, their world gets turned upside down where, you know, it concludes with, you know, both girls remaining asleep in their bedrooms and Rod Blagojevich being led out in handcuffs out the back entrance of the, or back exit of the house. And then she's left there with the silence of, you know, this house to kind of contemplate what had just happened.
I'm talking with Dave McKinney of member station WBEZ in Chicago. He's host of a new podcast that just kicked off called Public Official A. One episode is already out and more are on the way. We're talking about Rod Blagojevich's fall from grace and his removal from office and also the trial that took place. Dave, you mentioned you talked to a lot of different people, including Patty Blagojevich, and some people are not necessarily fans of the former governor or the Blagojevich family, and others may be. But did you worry at times that you might be giving a platform here for just what they want? Maybe try to, you know, grab some empathy from the public for him to get out of prison early?
Well, I mean, you look at what Mrs. Blagojevich in particular has been doing over many, many months. You know, she's been trying to get whatever, you know, to go on whatever platform she can to basically make the case that you know, her husband was wrongly convicted and then the prison sentence was unjust. And, you know, and I think had we just stuck with an interview of her, you know, that would have been a concern. But this is this podcast and the whole project is much more involved than that, where, you know, we really sought out the law enforcement people from, you know, as we mentioned, the FBI, the lead prosecutor in the case, Reed Schar. We sat down and had a lengthy conversation with the former Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, who, you know, her office gets involved in the whole Blagojevich saga because of the original accusation that came from Dick Mell, the you know, Mrs. Blagojevich's father, who, you know, back in 2005, early 2005, said that board and commission seats were being, you know, basically sold to the highest bidder. And what we heard from Madigan, you know, she was, you know, she just characterized the whole experience being a fellow office holder with Rod Blagojevich as the Blagojevich reign of terror. And she outlined this anecdote to us that, you know, it's really, I mean, that's the beauty of a project like this, where, you know, a lot's been written and said about these people, but hearing them retell this stuff in their own voices is quite something. Like, she talked about how after she began this investigation into the Mell accusation, that not long afterwards, the Blagojevich administration told all of the agency directors and agency lawyers that were under his control to stop communicating with anybody in the AG's office. And why that's significant is that, you know, they have, at any given time, 30,000 cases pending against the state of Illinois. And so there has to be kind of a line of communications open between the administration and the attorney general, which is, you know, representing the administration in court. But probably the biggest and most colorful piece of retribution beyond that that occurred as a result of her getting involved in this was that, you know, the bathroom in the Thompson Center for the attorney general's office, the bathrooms were basically allowed to kind of just devolve into, you know, non-working order where, you know, things would break. There would be leaks. There was no soap in it. And of course, the governor at that point, and still the case today, the governor controls the upkeep and operations of the Thompson Center. And so she looked at that as like, you know, they're messing around with us. They're screwing around and trying to, you know, make life difficult on us by turning our bathrooms into this kind of awful place. So, I mean, hearing anecdotes like that from participants was really a rich thing.
One of the people that you tried to get an interview with and did not, Rod Blagojevich, it seems as though things were moving along there from what you indicated, that you might have had a shot to talk with him. It seemed like you were going to get that opportunity, and then that opportunity went away.
Yeah, I mean, it appeared after, you know, again, as we mentioned, I mean, 6 hours of time roughly with Mrs. Blagojevich. I mean, I think she grew to get comfortable with both Colin, my producer, and me, and you know, she was all on board with her husband talking to us, and she said she'd talk to him, and it appeared that he was on board with it. And so, you know, it's a bit of a thing to coordinate interviews with people who are sitting in federal prison. You have to get approval of the prison system, and that can take weeks and months, and, you know, phone calls not being returned or emails not being answered. And finally, we get the approval of the prison in Colorado. You know, they say that, you know, we will, you know, let, we'll, you know, allow this to happen if we get, you know, cooperation from Blagojevich himself. And then the next thing we know is Blagojevich wants to talk to his lawyer. And we follow up then with Patty. And, you know, what we then come to learn is that in December, these guys believe that, you know, there is genuine movement at the White House towards some sort of commutation. And, you know, and it appeared with Trump tweeting about one of Patty's appearances on a Fox News program in December that there might be merit to that. But here we are, you know, midway through the month, and there's been silence. So I think that there has to be a level of frustration that, you know, this has not come to fruition yet.
Well, Dave, as I mentioned, you've just launched the first of the podcast episodes. You've got some more to come on this topic. And what else can we expect? Who will we be hearing from? Some of the other stories that will be out there?
You know, what we're trying to do is mix a little bit of detail about, you know, the family dysfunction. You know, that was, as I mentioned, Dick Mell and Rod Blagojevich, the two of them had a very strained relationship, I think, their entire lives. We talk about how Rod and Patty met. Talk about Rod's early career and his evolution into becoming governor. We spent a little time talking about kind of the way the two trajectories of both he and Barack Obama intersect, and then, you know, Obama totally, you know, his arc goes straight to the moon, and here Rod is, as he mentions on the tapes, stuck in Springfield. And you know, we go into the arrest. We'll be talking some about the, you know, the debate over whether 14 years is too long of a sentence. And, you know, Patty Blagojevich, in the case of the convicted Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, who shot and killed Laquan McDonald, Patty is, you know, out tweeting about how unjust it was that her husband has got a 14-year prison term and Van Dyke winds up getting 81 months. And so you get a flavor of all of that, the full picture. And as I mentioned at the very onset here, what makes this such an interesting, timely thing 10 years later is this question. Is Blagojevich, has he been in prison too long? And is Trump going to do something about it? And those really are kind of what make this a current story.
And we'll continue to follow along. And Dave McKinney of member station WBEZ, thanks for being with us today.
Sean, thanks for having me.
Want to listen to the podcast, Public Official A? We have a link at our website, statewideshow.com. One episode already available. There are more to come. This is Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll hear the story of a man who went from prison to college. His journey, that's on the way. Remember to check our website if you missed any of Statewide. You can find the stories from each episode at statewideshow.com. The number of jobs in cybersecurity is growing in Illinois, but while many companies say they need more workers, job applicants say they're having a hard time getting hired. And Mary Hansen explains for Illinois Newsroom that educators and businesses are working together to close the gap.
Weasel Forsythe's cubicle is decked out.
I have all my toys here that I have in my huge fidget cube, and then my Spider-Gwen. In my X-Force Deadpool.
She's an information assurance apprentice with Supertech, a government contracting firm in O'Fallon, Illinois, outside of St. Louis. Amid the color and chaos of superhero posters and figurines, Forsythe pulls out a big black binder.
I mean, this isn't really sexy, but I think it's awesome, is the NIST compliance.
It's hundreds of pages of technical language and guidelines laying out a framework for protecting companies and governments from hackers. She learned about the guide while getting her associate's degree in cybersecurity from St. Louis Community College. But she said when she first started looking for work, postings for entry-level jobs would ask for experience or certifications she didn't have yet.
When you are in college, you're here, but you still have to get somewhere to get over here where you have the security plus, where you have your clearance, and there's no path. You know, you can't get there from here usually.
And here's the confusing part. There are literally thousands of openings for cybersecurity positions, companies saying they need the skills that Forsythe has.
No, we don't have like 5 or 6 candidates to choose from. I mean, we're pretty fortunate to have at least one, if not maybe a couple.
Dan Schaefer is director of operations at Supertech. He says competition for professionals with skills in network security is tight, and it's a challenge across the country. The string of high-profile data breaches, think Marriott and Target, have businesses scrambling to ramp up their information security. So why are both applicants and companies frustrated?
Part of that is because they're not willing to train people up, and partly because schools in particular have not done a particularly good job of training for this area because things change and advance so quickly.
Todd Thibodeau runs CompTIA, a nonprofit that develops cybersecurity certification and training programs. One of the solutions, he says, better training. Making sure the skills being taught are the same ones companies are looking for.
Being able to say, okay, a cybersecurity analyst needs to have these kinds of skills, but those skills could probably be acquired over a 6-month period, not under a 2 or 4 year degree program.
Thibodeau's nonprofit runs 14-week trainings for security analysts around the U.S. They're in Chicago, Minneapolis, and Charlotte, and looking to expand. It's not just the education programs, though, that need to adapt. Thibodeau says employers also need to change the way they hire. A survey of cybersecurity job postings from 2015 found that 83% of them asked for at least 3 years of experience. The average requirement was 5 years.
The majority of companies want people that come out of a program and can walk in the door and be 80% of the way there.
Thibodeau says apprenticeships could be a part of the solution, too. Forsythe got her apprenticeship with the help of the Midwest Cyber Center. Tony Bryan is head of the St. Louis-based center.
And this idea of apprenticeship is a fairly new concept in industries that are not trade specific. You know, there's been a lot of education on our end to explain to employers the advantages of hiring apprenticeships.
Bryan says the advantage for companies is the structured training and support. For apprentices, they get the certifications they need while earning money in a job in the field. No previous education or training in cybersecurity is required to qualify for the program. Applicants just need to have a high school diploma or GED. Bryan says part of the goal is to attract people who aren't typically included in the cybersecurity workforce.
So for us, recruitment has been very targeted for women, people of color, and veterans.
They currently have a dozen apprentices, and the goal is to have 50 more this year. For Forsythe, it's helped her get the job she wants.
now I can do it because I have my schooling, I have the, what I've learned from Midwest Cyber Center, so that gives me the tools that now I can actually do the job I wanted, which is so exciting.
I'm Mary Hansen, Illinois Newsroom.
College has traditionally been the place young adults get the education they need to pursue a profession they're passionate about. For Illinois Issues, Dusty Rhodes visited one of the City Colleges of Chicago to meet some students whose life calling is dealing with death.
Alicia Adams attends Malcolm X College, which specializes in health sciences. But unlike most of her classmates, Adams isn't learning anything about saving lives.
It started with a guinea pig in third grade. I had the responsibility of taking care of it over the summer, and they don't live long, and so I died.
With her mom headed off to work that day, Adams was left in charge of disposing of the class pet, which was named Mr. Squeaky.
I put him in a box, I decorated it, and like I said, it was the summer, so I knew I had to get it like out of the house. So I put it in a grill outside.
Every day she checked back, just to make sure Mr. Squeaky hadn't been discovered by a raccoon.
I literally watched every stage of death with that guinea pig. And then the morbid curiosity afterwards led me to, like, dead people.
Adams is studying mortuary science at Malcolm X, one of only two community colleges in Illinois to offer such a degree. It prepares students to work as a funeral director, manage a funeral home, embalm the dead, or, like many funeral service providers, do all three. I asked another student, Anna Woolock, to list their courses for me.
Microbiology, pathology, history, thanatochemistry, it's the chemistry of death, embalming, accounting, restorative art, sociology, ethics, funeral directing, merchandising, business law, embalming lab, our capstone course, which is basically just getting us ready for the board exam, and psychology.
Woolock moved to Chicago to attend art school. She eventually got disillusioned and settled into the grind of creative day jobs, bookstores, coffee shops, record stores, and restaurants. But along with those customer service gigs, one of her side hobbies was taxidermy.
Just like I've done a few mice and a couple of rabbits. They make really nice gifts, like if you taxidermy them and you can like pose them for people.
A couple of years ago, she made an emergency trip home to Pittsburgh, where her mother was providing hospice care for her grandfather. The night he died, a blizzard made local roads impassable. Yet somehow, a pair of funeral directors made their way to the family home to collect her grandfather's remains.
It was like 5 o'clock in the morning. Everyone's tired. Everyone's exhausted and like has been crying. And then these like two incredibly dapper gentlemen show up. And they were the sweetest, most considerate people.
One tiny gesture stood out.
My mom had like passed out on the couch because this was like such a long ordeal for her. And one of the funeral directors picked up the Afghan and like tucked her in. And like that was such a moving moment.
In that instant, Woolock knew what she wanted to do.
The day that I came back, I opened up my computer and looked up mortuary programs Chicago, found Malcolm X, and applied.
Karen Scott, a licensed funeral director for more than 3 decades, runs the program at Malcolm X, where more than 40 students are enrolled. She sees what she calls the scientific side and the event planning side of the profession as just steps along the continuum of comfort.
Actually, if you think about it, it's a body. It's what we all are housed in, you know, and you just basically take them and take care of their body. Because what you're doing is you're giving that family some type of comfort. I won't say closure because that happens down the road, but you're giving them some kind of comfort.
Of course, people outside the profession don't necessarily see it that way. Woolock, who spends her evenings managing a restaurant, says she gets one of two reactions.
So it's really interested or just completely just horrified.
Adams' after-school time is spent with her two children, Ty, age 7, and Victoria, age 4. She doesn't tell them much about what she's studying.
They only know, like, she cares for dead people.
Adams and Woolock are anomalies in the mortuary trade. Most funeral homes are family businesses, passed down from one generation to the next, so they aren't sure they'll get to work in their chosen profession. Just in case, Adams plans to get her bachelor's degree at Southern Illinois University with a minor in forensics, Woolock is considering furthering her studies in thanatology. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
This is Statewide. Like many people coming out of prison, Perry Klein never thought he'd go to college. But Klein beat the odds and graduated last month. In this report from Illinois Newsroom, Lee Gaines explains his story shows how important access to higher education is after prison and how much more colleges need to do to support formerly incarcerated students.
Klein grew up in Chicago. As a teenager, he was wrongly accused of a robbery, and he spent months in juvenile detention for a crime he says he didn't commit. And after he was released, he says his high school failed him.
I really didn't feel like I had a lot of support, you know, from the school, you know, because of that traumatic experience. Nobody came to me and gave me any counseling. I didn't go to a school like that.
Without the proper support he needed, Klein dropped out. He started hanging out with gangs and committing crimes. He spent time in Illinois prisons, and he got addicted to heroin. Then, in 2013, something happened that made Klein realize he needed to change. A friend overdosed on heroin in front of him. Instead of going to get help, Klein left to get more drugs. His friend later died.
You know, I could have saved him, you know, but I was thinking about getting that next one. I remember getting down on my knees. And I remember praying to God and asking me to get me out of this madness. And he did.
Klein got out of Chicago. An old girlfriend bought him a bus ticket to Champaign. When he arrived, he was homeless and in withdrawal. It was a pivotal moment for Klein. Then came another one. He started going to Narcotics Anonymous religiously. He told one of his friends from NA that he wanted to go to college.
One day, I was helping him move. And after we got through moving, he drove me right up to Parkland College, and he said, get out. He said, go register for school, and I did it.
When he enrolled in the college, he placed into a lot of remedial classes, and he struggled.
Math was, like, my worst subject ever. So I had, like, started, like, real low in math. It was, like, straight humiliation. But I stuck it out, was there every day, you know, passing the test and going to the next level.
Sticking it out is unusual for formerly incarcerated students. That's according to one of Klein's advisors at Parkland College, Larry Taylor. He says Klein had a lot of factors working against him.
Black males in general are most at risk of not graduating and earning a degree. You couple that with being formerly incarcerated. So most of those students that I've worked with that were incarcerated, I can't think of maybe one or two that actually completed their academic goals.
But Klein got something he needed from the faculty and staff at Parkland, and that's support. He asked for help, and he received it. He spent hours outside of class working one-on-one with professors. And with Taylor's help, he got into the University of Illinois. Then he graduated.
Perry Klein.
That's Klein walking across the stage at his graduation from the U of I last month. Lots of people came to see him graduate, including his math professor from Parkland, Aaron Wilding Martin.
It was an emotional day. I was so proud of all the work that he's done. And there's an English professor here who also likes to keep track of how he's doing and keep in touch. And I took a picture of him going across the stage and texted to her, I'm not crying, you're crying.
Joni Schwartz says those kinds of emotional bonds between professors and formerly incarcerated students aren't unusual. They're actually necessary for students like Klein to succeed.
Someone who is there for them, accepts them unconditionally, and provides emotional, spiritual, academic support to them, that is key to their success.
Schwartz co-edited the book Race, Education, and Reintegrating Formerly Incarcerated Citizens. She says colleges need to proactively seek out formerly incarcerated people to offer that support. She suggests even going into the prisons to plant the seed that education is an option. Klein says getting his GED in prison planted that seed. And getting a college degree made all the difference in his life.
It's the floodgates to open up everything. I don't care what happened to you, you know, how your past went. getting the education brings like so many possibilities.
Klein says he found his purpose in life, and that's helping others. He plans to pursue a master's degree in social work next. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
That story produced with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. And a reminder, coming up next week, more on Perry Klein's story here on Statewide. That does it for this episode. We're glad you could be with us. Remember to check the website, statewideshow.com, for anything you might have missed. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.